So these are the moments that tell the stories that, well, you probably should know about today.
There are more than 120 Americans that are shot and killed every day, with hundreds more shot and wounded.
Again, we have all the cards. They have no military left, practically. They have no leaders left. We don't know who the leaders are. Nobody knows who the leader. I don't think they know who the leaders are, very importantly.
Yeah, we're going to have all of those stories. And by the way, you know what else we're going to have? Because the Iranian delegation has now been meeting with the Russian delegation, not the Pakistani delegation or the American delegation. And that's just been happening in the last couple of hours. We're going to be joined here by Professor Mohammad Mirandi. Perfect guy to be able to talk to about something like this as it's happening here on the Sanchez Effect. So let's do it. Hello again, everybody. I'm Rick Sanchez. And before we begin tonight, just a note to let you know that we're now available and seen by some 10 to 20 million people a week in five different languages. Thank you for being there. Now, let's go to the shooting. The shooting at the Correspondents' Dinner in Washington, D.C. This is an event that I've been invited to in the past. I chose not to go. Why? I just don't, that journalists should be partying with the people that they're supposed to be covering. Trading favorable coverage for access happens way too often in Western media. It's a relationship that's become too cozy to the point where they now, like, work together. In fact, I would argue that the U.S. corporate media in particular is among the most corrupt in the entire world. Yes, I said it, among the most corrupt in the entire world. Please, look, feel free to quote me if you're listening to my words. You know why? Because I can bring the receipts if I have to, and I'd be happy to do it. So let's continue now. Okay, here's the scene at the Correspondents' Dinner, in case you missed it. All right, so this is the moment when they realize what's going on. They grab the vice president. They try to grab the president. A gunman who had checked into the hotel the night before somehow got near the event with several weapons, and he started firing. President Trump seems to fall or throw himself to the ground as he's being hurried off the stage, leading many to wonder if there's something fishy going on here. I don't think there is, by the way, from what I've been able to see. Meanwhile, the so-called correspondents who are supposed to represent the voice of their American people, what are they doing? They're hiding behind their glasses of Chardonnay as they watch this chaos unfold. These, by the way, are not real journalists. Real journalists work for the people and are supposed to have an adversarial relationship with their government. They're not supposed to kiss their behinds. These people, they party with them. They fail to press them on the most important issues, like unnecessary wars, rampant political corruption, foreign influence, out-of-control gun violence. Speaking of out-of-control gun violence, and then, gee, what a surprise. Out-of-control gun violence breaks out right there, right in front of them. And like cowards, all they can do is hide. Okay, this is Cole Allen. Let me show you his picture. That's what the guy looks like. What he did Saturday night, and this is important, right? This is a part of the story others won't tell you. What he did is not surprising. It's not even shocking. It's a daily occurrence in America, one that should have been addressed by America's so-called journalists and the government officials that they protect. But they failed to deal with it. And they'll fail to deal with it in the future, even after it visits them, as we just saw here, directly. You know why? Because both they, as members of the corporate media, and the government elites that they protect, these people are essentially bought off by the violence industry. Yeah, the violence industry. Defense contractors, gun manufacturers, well-heeled donors who bury or obscure this story that I'm about to tell you about under hundreds of millions of dollars in what are essentially bribes, payoffs. And what is the story that they're burying? It's this. that gun violence in America is a gruesome and dangerous epidemic. More dangerous, in fact, than even some war zones in the world where the U.S. has participated. Look at this quote from research compiled by the Journal of the American Medical Association, JAMA, you know them. They confirmed in 2022 that for young men in the most violent zip codes in places like Chicago and Philadelphia, the risk of firearm-related death surpassed combat risks faced by military personnel during the war in Iraq. Think about what that says. Think about what that says. It means that a young man or a young woman would have been statistically safer in Iraq during the war than they would have been living in a place like Philadelphia or Chicago or Los Angeles or many others. See, when it comes to gun violence, the United States has no competition. And that's a story that should be told. The homicide rate in America is 25 times higher than that of every other high-income country in the world. 25 times. And when it comes to mass shootings, the U.S. doesn't just lead the world, it leads all the world's continents. Look at this study conducted by the Economic Journal Watch. That's the U.S. rate right there on the left. See that? Look how it compares to mass shootings in other parts of the world. Look at Europe. Look at Asia. Look at Africa. Look at South America. Not even close, right? And yet, in those places, there are many more people represented because they have a bigger population. Fact is, the U.S. represents 30% of all mass shootings worldwide, even though it only has 5% of the world's population.
A familiar scene in the United States, a university campus on lockdown after a mass shooting.
Yet again in America, a mass shooting at a school, this time an elementary school.
Mass shooting at a Mormon church in Michigan.
Shooting at an ice rink in Rhode Island.
Mass shooting at a child's birthday party in California.
There are more than 120 Americans that are shot and killed every day, with hundreds more shot and wounded.
It happens so much, even the reporters sound bored reporting it, because it's just almost a daily occurrence. And it's not just mass shootings that are in high numbers in America. Shootings in total far exceed those of any other economically developed country in the entire world. Again, it's not even close. In fact, Americans are roughly 10 to 80 times more likely to be killed in a shooting than people living in any other economically developed country in the world, and that includes all the European countries, as well as Japan, as well as China, as well as Russia, as well as Australia, and you can throw in Iran if you want to. Aside from the war, of course. So now ask yourself this. Which countries, developed or otherwise, do have homicide rates that are very high and comparable to the homicide rates in the United States? Yes, there's places in the world where there's a high homicide rate. So I look for them, and I put a little map together so you can see it, right? Ecuador, Venezuela, Honduras, Mexico, Brazil, Jamaica. And now you're going to notice something. All of these countries have something in common. They're all impacted by the United States geographically, and or by the fact that Americans consume the drugs that they produce in these countries, or by the fact that the U.S. gun manufacturers supply the cartels with weapons in these countries, or by the fact that the United States has destabilized these countries by intervening politically, militarily, or economically, like what they did in Venezuela. You see the picture? These countries have begun to take on the characteristics of the United States, mostly the bad characteristics. I'm sorry, but this is an important story. The Chardonnay-sipping media hiding under their tables at the correspondents' dinners, they won't tell you this. They can't tell you this. They won't tell you how the corrupt elites who buy government officials have turned the U.S. into a country whose number one export, the number one export of the United States of America is violence. Violence. And it's happening right now again. If you think about it, Persian Gulf states. Let me show you some pictures. Look how beautiful these places are. Persian Gulf states like the UAE, with both Abu Dhabi and Dubai, Doha and Qatar, He's a long represented one of the most affluent, peaceful, and economically stable locations in the world, along with other Persian Gulf countries. But now, thanks to the United States and Israel's attack on Iran, it's anything but peaceful, anything but stable. In fact, it's so bad, the UAE is now asking U.S. taxpayers for a bailout. Look at this headline in the Wall Street Journal. It reveals how they have approached the United States looking for an economic lifeline from you, if you happen to be watching me right now in the United States and you pay taxes there.
UAE Central Bank Governor Khalid Mohammed Balama raised the idea of a currency swap line with Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent. The Emiratis emphasized that they had so far avoided the worst economic effects of the conflict, but might still need a financial lifeline, the officials said.
So this, like the more general story of how the U.S. exports violence worldwide and the effect it has on the daily lives of Americans, see, I, you know, maybe it's me, but I think this is a story worth telling, especially on a day like this after this shooting. But you won't hear this in most places. It's hidden. It's hidden right under the tables at the correspondents' dinner with these so-called journalists who are supposed to be telling the American people the truth, but they don't. They don't. Even when it happens right under their noses. Look, the American people deserve better. They deserve better because they're good people. But they barely have a chance to know the truth. And by the way, what Americans too often don't know, the rest of the world does. Why? Because while Western and corporate media is compliant to the T, media in other countries, not so much. Neither are many alternative media platforms out there. And by the way, lately, and surprisingly, one of the best examples of that that people are watching by the tens of millions are these videos that are being put out on behalf of Iran. Here's the latest one. Boy, they're hitting that Epstein theme, and they're hitting it hard, as they are a couple of other things. And it's somewhat masterful. And we're going to be joined soon here by the guy who puts those videos together. It's pretty fascinating what's happening with that. But all right, joining us now to talk about some of this is none other than Mohammed Morandi. He is a professor at Tehran University. He's also one of the most respected and knowledgeable insiders on all things Iran. And by the way, let me just say as an aside from a personal standpoint, he happens to be a very decent man, for what it's worth. And I want to start with what seems now like something that seems indecent. Here's the president of the United States, Professor Morandi, talking moments ago about the negotiations and how they're going. Here's what he has to say. I want to get your reaction on the other side. Play it, Gene.
We canceled the trip. We have all the cards. We're not going to spend 15 hours in airplanes all the time going back and forth to be giving a document that was not good enough. And so we'll deal by telephone, and they can call us anytime they want. Again, we have all the cards. They have no military left, practically. They have no leaders left. We don't know who the leaders are. Nobody knows who the leader. I don't think they know who the leaders are, very importantly. So
no leadership, no military, nothing. We might talk to him, we might not, and you know what? I don't even think I want to talk to him anymore. What do you make of that comment?
I think it's another sign of desperation, to be very blunt. He has gambled in this war, and it failed, and he should have known from the beginning what's going to happen. He apparently, from what we hear, did not foresee the Iranians retaliating against American positions in the Persian Gulf, nor did he foresee the Iranians taking control of the Strait of Hormuz. And I think also, in addition to that, the United States in general underestimated Iran's missile and drone capabilities and the sheer number of missiles and drones that they have in their underground bases and their production capabilities. Mm-hmm. So now he wants to get concessions at the negotiating table that he failed to get on the battlefield, and that's simply not going to happen. So unless he changes course, I think that it's quite possible that we will have another war of aggression carried out by the United States against Iran.
Just for the sake of clarity, he mentioned two things, and I want you to address them. He says that Iran has no leadership and Iran has no military left. Are any of those things true?
I think by now everyone knows that his claims are both false. Iran's leadership is—it's clear who they are. There's a constitution. We have a leader. We have a president. We have the head of the judiciary, the head of parliament. We have the chair of the Supreme National Security Council. And in the case of negotiating with Americans, it is the Supreme National Security Council that has the most important role. And whatever decision they make and the leader agrees with it, it is carried out. And they have assigned the Speaker of Parliament, Dr. Ghalibaf, who is also a member of the Supreme National Security Council, to be in charge of negotiations. So it's clear as day that every aspect of Iranian society has its own, has people responsible for managing it. And in the case of strategic affairs, the Supreme National Security Council's role is very clear. The armed forces have representatives. The government has representatives. The head of the three branches of government are present, and the leader has two of his own representatives in that council. So obviously there are always going to be divisions. There are going to be divisions in any country. But at the end of the day, the decision, whatever debates there are, whatever discussions there are, when Dr. Ghalibaf sits down and makes a decision, then with the support of the Supreme National Security Council and the leader, that is the final say.
I have to ask you this question, because I thought about this a lot. I was never sure that this war was actually going to happen. I didn't think it would happen. But I was thinking that if it happened, there was a real good chance that it would not turn out well for Iran. Obviously, Iran has proven me wrong, as they've proven most people in the world wrong. What did you think? Are you surprised that Iran is suddenly in a better condition militarily, economically, in the eyes of the world, with its hold on both the Persian Gulf and through its association with Yemen in other parts of the Gulf as well? I mean, all of these things that are happening, that's not Rick Sanchez saying this, and I know it's not Mohammed Mirani saying this. There's a lot of people that I interview and experts all over the world are saying this. Did you foresee it?
Yes, I was confident that the United States would be defeated in this war, and I was confident that Hezbollah, too, would perform well under these circumstances, that this war, this 39-day war that we saw. I would say that perhaps the armed forces and the state performed a bit better than I expected, but ultimately I expected the United States to fail. And I think the problem really is that the Americans, the elites in Washington, they believe their own propaganda. The media is basically repeating the narratives that American leaders want to hear. And, you know, there have been sane people in Washington who've said, who've spoken out and said the truth, but mm-hmm. they were always punished and sidelined. I mean, there are two people who worked in the White House, like Flint and Hillary Mann Leverett. They worked under the George Bush White House. Flint Leverett resigned over the Iraq War. Then as academics, they sat down and wrote a book called Going to Tehran. Mm-hmm. And they dealt with many of the myths about Iran. They spoke about the dangers that lie ahead if there isn't some sort of rapprochement. Here we are today. Hmm. And they gave a roadmap. And they were hammered by everyone, literally, think tankers, policymakers, elites. It's a very good book. I think everyone should read it. But they were sidelined and marginalized. And instead, the United States followed the demands of Zionists. So there were people in the United States who had knowledge, who were knowledgeable, who were doing research. But the system doesn't allow for that sort of knowledge to be repeated and to become policy. Instead, you're punished for looking at the situation objectively. And even, for example, for many years, I've been saying that if the United States attacks Iran, Iran would punish it in the Persian Gulf. But I was always ridiculed by Western journalists and policymakers as a propagandist for the regime, as they like.
Well, no, that's not true. Hold on. You know why I think they may have doubted you and people like me? Because, you know, Professor Mohammed Mirandi, we have all been told the United States has the greatest military in the history of the world, that its anti-ballistic defense system is incomprehensible in terms of what it can do. And all of that has been proven wrong. But who would have thunk that would be that way? Who would have thought that the Patriot missile system is essentially a piece of crap compared to what we were told it was going to be? Right? I mean, you can't blame people for...
Yeah, well, I don't mean you, Rick. Obviously, you're a good close friend, and we've spent a lot of time together discussing things. I mean those mainstream Western journalists who today basically repeat anything that the White House says or that the political establishment says. Even those who despise Trump, when it comes to the empire, they're still going to repeat the nonsense that they're told to say. They may despise him, but they're still a part of that class, which many of us now call the Epstein class, where they're influenced by or controlled by the Epstein class. So they fail to listen, whether it's listening to people like yourself or me or the authors of Going to Tehran and others. The problem is that they are all sitting and repeating one another, and ultimately that's what has caused this situation for the United States. And instead of learning their foolishness, they double down.
You know what we learn in books like the one you mentioned, Going to Tehran, is that the Israeli, as you say, Zionist crowd has been trying to get the United States to do this for the longest time. They tried to get Bush to do this and Clinton to do this and Obama to do this. And all the presidents who came before Trump were told, you have to invade Iran, you have to attack Iran, you have to start a war with Iran. Why do you think it took Trump to be the one who fell for this persuasion or this argument?
That's an excellent question, and I really have no idea. I think part of it has to do with the sheer influence of the Zionist lobby and the extraordinary amount of money that he has received from the Zionist lobby, which is unprecedented. But then there are questions about whether he's compromised or not. And some of his decisions when you think about it, some of his decisions defy any logic, that they defy any reason. And even that sort of money that he gets from the Zionist lobby still doesn't make those decisions make sense. So in my opinion, the chances that he's deeply compromised, I think they're
Yeah, you're breaking up just a little bit, but let's stay with this because I think it's an important video. I want to play some sound here. This is because it goes to Mr. Trump's character somewhat. This is right after the Iranian supreme leader had been assassinated, essentially taken out with his family. And Mr. Trump made a comment about it. And I want you, if we have that, Gene, to play that for us. Here it is.
Iran's formerly supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, is dead. This wretched and vile man had the blood of hundreds and even thousands of Americans on his hands and was responsible for the slaughter of countless thousands of innocent people all across many countries. Last night, all over Iran, the voices of the Iranian people could be heard cheering and celebrating in the streets when his death was announced.
I'm wondering if just the opposite actually happened. In fact, I'm not so much wondering, but my sources in Iran tell me that's exactly what's happened. This kind of language to assassinate someone and then just trash them and call them wretched and vile. I'm wondering, Professor, if that didn't turn people toward the government even more so than they were when I was there visiting with Iranians. Is that the case?
Oh, absolutely. You know, in Iran, according to polls that have been carried out over the years, the Islamic Republic has always had a high degree of public legitimacy.
Yeah.
And the leader always topped all other public figures in popularity. He has his opponents. There are people who hate him. You can meet them on the streets. You can meet them in taxis, on buses, on campus. But he's always been a respected person. His martyrdom has made him a superstar in the eyes of so many Iranians. And ever since he was murdered, every night on the streets of Tehran and across the country, you see huge crowds gathering. In Tehran, because it's so big, they're spread out in different neighborhoods. When I leave home at night, let's say to go to a studio somewhere for an interview, I pass, if it's far off, I pass by many of these gatherings. And it's been going off for 2 months. It's clear that the unity that we have today is perhaps unprecedented, even perhaps, because I was a child back then, even perhaps more so than during the beginning of the revolution. But let me give you just one piece of evidence that is no one can refute, and that is that when he was murdered, alongside a number of senior military officials who were in a separate meeting, the Iranian armed forces immediately responded within an hour. And people on the streets, they did not rush to gas stations. There were no huge queues or lines in supermarkets to take bread or other, you know, canned food or whatever it is people do in these times of crisis. Things were very normal. For a full week, we didn't have a new leader. Of course, in accordance with the Constitution, we had a leadership council comprised of the president, the head of the judiciary, and a representative from the Guardian Council. But we didn't have a leader, and we couldn't have a leader for a full week because they were trying to bomb their gathering, the gathering that would choose the new leader, the Expediency Council. So for a full week, we had no leader, yet the armed forces and the state, the government, the different government institutions that were being bombed were functioning normally, and people were going about their daily lives. And that show, and people were on the streets, of course, in huge numbers. And that shows that it was the people during that critical week that were holding things together, that were making sure that the country functioned normally, that made sure everything was stable and quiet. So what Trump says is, of course, the same sort of nonsense that he always says when he speaks about Iran. But that is a part of the narrative in the West that makes them always miscalculate when it comes to Iran. So I think it's it's understandable that people would think that Iran would fail and be defeated, not because people are like them, but because people are so overwhelmed by the propaganda. People, not just in the United States, across the world. Friends of mine in China and elsewhere, who I've been, they've said the exact same thing that you've been saying, that you've said, that they thought Iran would collapse. They thought Iran wouldn't be able to last for more than a few days. Iran experts, experts of our region, people who are very good friends and who are knowledgeable. But the power of the empire, the media of the empire, and the narrative of that media is so overwhelming that people find it difficult to imagine that the United States, the superpower, could be defeated in such a way.
What happens now with Iran? Because by all indications, Iran is now a force to be reckoned with and considered among many experts, including experts from Johns Hopkins University, Professor Hanke, who is a worldly recognized economist, who told me last week that Iran has now joined the family of countries that make up the most economically viable and important countries in the world, right there with China, right there with Russia and India, and of course, the United States. Because of what it's shown it can do militarily, because Iran now controls and will continue to control the Persian Gulf, because of its relationship with Yemen controlling other straits that are important, it now holds 30% of the world's LNG, oil, and fertilizer, for example. That puts Iran in a whole completely different place, not to mention that the economy is stronger now than it was before the attack. How do you put all this in perspective for people?
Well, I agree that in the future of Iran will be different from the past. Iran will be much stronger than before, and that is largely due to Trump himself. His own foolishness has exposed the weaknesses of the United States and has revealed Iran's strengths. And it has shown the vulnerability of U.S. proxies and allies in our region. And of course, Iran has been forced to take control of the Strait of Hormuz. Not that it had any ambitions to do so before the war, but after the war, they said, well, we're going to take reparations from these countries that helped the United States in our region. And we want to make sure that in future, the Persian Gulf is not a platform for another war against Iran. However, for the time being, the main discussion here is what next? And that is something that no one really knows.
Well, let's talk about that, because the United States is saying that, that they're going to negotiate, then they're saying they're not going to negotiate. Then they send the vice president, but the vice president doesn't come with a plan. The Iranians come with the plan, and the United States doesn't know what to say about that plan. Then Mr. Trump insists that he wants to send Jared Kushner and Mr. Witkoff, two people who I don't understand why the Iranians would even sit down and talk to them, given their background. And I mean, it's a fair word to say, even as a journalist, backstabbing in the past during negotiations, and their ties to Bibi Netanyahu, and the fact that Bibi Netanyahu has now gone on camera and saying that the people who negotiate with Iran report to him after they're done with the negotiations. This puts Iran in a position where one would ask, why should they negotiate with the United States if it's not a good faith negotiation, right? What is the Iranian position on negotiating right now with the United States?
Well, as you know, Iran is preparing for war, and war could be very close. But still, Iran does negotiate because Iran wants the international community and the Iranian people to know that they try. They want to be seen as the reasonable side, as they've done in the past. Before the 12-day war, we were negotiating, even though we knew that the United States was going to, and the Israeli regime were going to attack. This previous war, the Ramadan war, the 39-day war that we just we've finished the first part of it, at least, that too, it, I'm sure you recall, before it began, we were negotiating with the Americans, and the Omani foreign minister said progress, significant progress had been made. But Iran knew that the United States was going to attack. But still, they wanted Iranian, because, you know, in Iran, a lot of people, for many reasons, and you mentioned a couple yourself, they're very united today. But the government, the state, they want to make sure that those people who are sort of in the middle or sort of in the gray zone, that they see that the Iranian side is not the problem. Hmm. And negotiations does a lot, carrying out, especially when you do it with someone like Trump, who is, who has destroyed U.S. soft power more than anyone else in U.S. history. So when you are seen as negotiating and the United States is seen as threatening your country with annihilation and threatening to wipe out a civilization, obviously that creates much more sympathy both at across the world, but also at home, it creates more resistance and resilience against potential strikes. So if the United States attacks tonight or tomorrow night or sometime in the near future, which is quite possible, if not probable, the resilience of ordinary Iranians is enhanced by the fact that they know that their government tried to prevent this.
When you say attacks, well, they've already attacked. You mean using ground troops or initiating the Marines? Or haven't they already done that in the story we were told about that helicopter or plane that was shot down?
Yes, what they were really out to do was to find the Iran's enriched uranium and steal it. But also we had 39 days of heavy airstrikes day and night, 24 hours a day. 400 people were slaughtered on day one, 168 little school children at an elementary school, mostly girls in the city of Minab were wiped out. And the Americans never acknowledged their role in this, nor did they let alone apologize for it. So this could start all over again, because Trump, instead of seeking an off-ramp, he's so far, it seems as if he may be choosing escalation. He could have had an off-ramp when the Iranian, we all remember that when there was a ceasefire agreement, there's supposed to be a regional ceasefire, and then Iran would allow extra tankers that belong to those countries that helped the United States in its war against Iran, Kuwait, the Emirates, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and Bahrain. Iran was supposed to allow more of their ships to go through the Strait of Hormuz. Netanyahu broke the ceasefire by carpet bombing Lebanon. Mm-hmm. And so Iran refrained from allowing those extra ships to go through. Then finally, after 10 days, Netanyahu was forced to stop. And Iran said, okay, now we're going to open the Strait of Hormuz to extra shipping. And then Trump, instead of using this as an opportunity, as an off-ramp, he said, I'm going to continue an embargo, a siege on Iranian ports. And so Iran said, well, if that's what you're going to do, then we're not going to allow those ships to go through it. And now we are where we are. So we are at a point where it's difficult to envisage how Trump is going to find an off-ramp. And so I think the chances for escalation are quite high, even though some people are saying that the U.S. military are cautioning him against it, but Trump is Trump.
If Trump attacks the Iran even more or further, or uses ground troops or any of a bevy of things that I guess the U.S. military could do, although most military officials that I have spoken to say it would be a fool's errand, what would be Iran's response? I ask you this because there's been a lot of talk about hitting the desalination plants inside the Persian Gulf countries, which would truly wreck the economies of those countries and create a huge immigration problem, perhaps even globally. Would Iran do that?
Well, Iran doesn't want this war. Iran was a victim of the war, and these countries enabled the war. They helped the United States carry out the war. And if the United States launches a second phase in this war, or second stage in this war, they will be complicit because without them, it's not possible. Iran will retaliate in accordance, based upon the actions of the U.S. and the Israeli regime. If they start striking critical Iranian infrastructure, then Iran will do the same to the Israeli regime and to those countries in the Persian Gulf that enabled these strikes. The problem for these regimes in particular is that we are heading towards the hot months in the Persian Gulf, hot and humid. And I'm sure you know exactly how it is in places like Dubai and elsewhere. If they strike Iranian critical infrastructure, Iran will have to retaliate in order, that is their deterrence. And if that happens, then people will have to leave because these countries are deserts and the heat and the humidity will make it unsustainable. And even U.S. troops in these countries will not be able to stay any longer because the weather will be terrible in literally in a month from now. It will start on usually in mid-May, it starts to get hot. But by the end of May and the beginning of June, it becomes really intolerable unless you have, especially for people who lived a very easy lifestyle.
You know, I'm wondering why Iran continues to negotiate with the United States and if it might be in its interest to create more of a multilateral approach to these negotiations. I understand Oman's place. I understand Pakistan's place. Let me show you some videos of some of the things that were happening just a few hours ago. This is Foreign Minister Arachi in St. Petersburg meeting with the Russian delegation. There he is. As a matter of fact, look, shaking hands with the president of Russia, President Putin. There's, as you know, Mr. Lavrov, his counterpart. The Russians obviously are allies of the Iranians, as are the Chinese, as are many other countries around the world. You know, I wonder if it would not be in the interest of Iran to start creating a more balanced, maybe a more diverse approach to these negotiations and telling the United States something to the effect that that's fine. Listen, we'll negotiate with you, but we're bringing in some more people to do these negotiations and ask maybe the Russians or the Chinese or the Indians or whoever to be a part of this as well.
I think the problem is in Washington. Actually, right now, Iran isn't negotiating with the United States. It only negotiated for one day. I was in Islamabad during the negotiations. Before that, it was just messages back and forth. And since then, it's been messages back and forth. And just recently, when the foreign minister, the Iranian foreign minister, went to Pakistan again, the Americans were talking about that there are going to be negotiations, but they were just making it up. There was no truth to it. And the Iranians said, we're not staying here, and we're not going to Pakistan, and we're not going to stay here to speak with Witkoff or anyone else on behalf of the United States. But I think, when the negotiations did take place in Islamabad a couple of weeks ago, the problem was that the Americans did not have the authority. I mean, Vance did not have the authority to make decisions. I mean, he was surrounded. There were three on the Iranian side, three on the American side. Kushner and Witkoff surrounded Vance. So you can imagine how the talks would go nowhere because these two people were basically Israeli firsters, but also Vance was constantly on the phone. He was throughout the day. He made a dozen phone calls, including apparently to Netanyahu. So a person who's constantly making phone calls like that at the negotiating table obviously does not have authority to make decisions. Whereas the Iranian side, they didn't make any phone calls to Tehran because they knew what they could discuss and how far they could go. So the problem is that whether it's just bilateral or whether there's mediation or the mediation is more heavyweight, I don't think it makes a difference when you have a Trump in power who's utterly impulsive and perhaps not completely sane. I just don't think it works. Unless Trump is forced to recognize that continuing this conflict is going to be catastrophic for the U.S. economy, the global economy, and that the United States simply will not win, I think there's no way that he's going to be able to be separated from the course that the Zionists and the Israeli regime have dictated to him or imposed upon him or convinced him to pursue.
I heard you make a comment about the Iranians fearing that the United States would assassinate the negotiators because they, well, have assassinated negotiators in the past. Did you make that comment? And what did you mean by it, if you did?
Yes, when we were on our way to Islamabad, I don't know if it was before the flight or during the flight or when we were there, there was an opinion piece published by the Washington Post. And that opinion piece was saying that the United States should murder the negotiators. And the feeling was that on our way back, we would probably, or quite possibly, be our plane would be downed. It would be struck by missiles, Israeli or U.S. missiles.
Yeah.
Yes, because the Washington Post is, you know, close to the CIA, and you know better than I the role that it plays in, you know, with regards to the deep state. So the concern was that they would shoot down the plane. To the credit of everyone on the delegation, all the men and women boarded the plane. No one said they would like to stay behind to visit Pakistan for a few days and visit different sites or anything like that. Everyone got back on the plane. And we flew back to the city of Mashhad near the border with Afghanistan and Turkmenistan. And then we came back to Tehran on that.
Were you worried? You personally?
Yes, all of us. I came back by train. Some came back by car. We came back by different means, but Mashhad to Tehran is, I think, almost 1,000 kilometers. So it was we spent the night on the road.
Hey, let me ask you.
On a train.
Oh, I'm sorry. Let me ask you about what the U.S. seems to be saying, at least according to Reuters, and that is that they're saying, for now, it's all about just opening the Strait of Hormuz. Open the Strait of Hormuz, and we're not interested in talking about the nuclear issue at this point. Let's just work out something on the Strait of Hormuz, and we'll table all that stuff and talk about it later. What do you make of that proposal if, as Reuters reports it, it's true?
Well, the problem is that, Rick, you know Washington better than I shouldn't be saying this to you, but we saw that when we were negotiating with the United States, they were conspiring to wage war against us twice.
Yeah.
And there's no reason to believe that as you and I are speaking, they're not preparing an assault on the country, a murderous assault again.
Yeah.
Trump, you know, in his desperation could do anything. And of course, Netanyahu is pushing as hard as possible to have this war continue. Reasonable people would recognize that what Trump is doing is destroying the global economy. And if he continues down this destructive path, it will lead to a global economic depression, not a recession, but a depression. So, well, I'm sure there are sane people in Washington who are warning about this. But Trump, I think he cares more about himself than he cares about anything else. And he does not want to be seen as defeated. But I see no road to victory for him. The only way out would be for him to just declare victory and walk away and have his people keep repeating that he was victorious. But the chances that he will double down and gamble in the hope that somehow he'll be able to defeat Iran, I think, is quite high. So it really doesn't matter what the Trump team or the Trump regime is saying. Iran is preparing for the worst, but at the same time, Iran is prepared to negotiate if the United States first abides by its current commitments. We have a ceasefire deal, and Israel is slaughtering people in Lebanon in violation of that agreement, and the United States has imposed a siege on Iranian ports. if we're going to go to the negotiating table, first, what has already been agreed upon has to be implemented by the Americans.
Sounds like there isn't really a ceasefire then. In fact, most would say there isn't. Hey, let's talk about something that's somewhat sensitive. We just mentioned nukes and that the United States are saying, well, we can talk about nukes later. We're going to let that go for now, if that is in fact the case, as reported by Reuters. The Supreme Leader, who was assassinated by the United States, had a no-nuke fatwa, reportedly. And there are now questions as to whether his son, who has taken over for him, who some say is a little more aggressive than his father, that's the description that's used by some. I'm not confirming that, obviously. Is less apt to want to continue that fatwa. What can you tell us about that?
I don't know if his son or if Ayatollah Sayyid Mujtaba Khamenei has views that are very different from that of Ayatollah, the martyred Ayatollah Khamenei. Mm-hmm. I really don't know. I've never heard anything from, because he wasn't a public figure before his father's martyrdom. People, if he walked down the streets, people wouldn't have known who he was.
Really?
He was never on television, never in the media. He taught in seminaries at a very high level students at seminaries. He worked in his father's office. He studied at university as well as religious seminaries and universities. He lectured, but he was not a public figure. So he knows about since he worked in his father's office, he knows about, you know, politics and the state. And he's also, as I said, a high ranking scholar as well. Hmm. But he's not known by the public. And so I've never heard him say anything specific about Iran's nuclear posture. But I have not seen any sign of Iran changing its position with regards to nuclear weapons. And so I must conclude that Iran's position is that it opposes nuclear weapons.
Final question, because I know I've taken a lot of your time, and you're always so kind to do this, but you and I haven't talked for a long time other than by text or whatever when we chat about life and things. So I'm thinking about every time I watch you on Piers Morgan or any of these shows out there, I see you tussle with the way the world is drawn up according to some of these idiots that you have the misfortune of having to take questions from. To them, for example, Iran is only a regime and it's never a government. The leaders are always described as radicals and they're never really leaders. They don't even give them the credit to be that kind of thing. So there's this word game that's always played, making people in the West in particular think that Iran is not a legitimate government, it's not even a legitimate country, that the people there are all oppressed, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You know the story better than I do. So could you draw out for people, I saw it for myself, obviously, and I have to share with our viewers that when I was there, I found the Iranian people to be some of the kindest people I've ever seen anywhere. I found that their leaders were willing to take difficult questions from me, which sometimes I ask them, are you doing enough? Why are you not doing enough in the economy? Did you punish these people who were in these protests? Did you kill people who were in these protests? Are you going to give them a fair trial, et cetera, et cetera? I asked all of these questions in Iran, same type of questions that I would have asked the United States. And I stopped at mullahs in the streets and asked them questions about who the hell they are and what they do and what they represent. So I really felt like when I was in Iran, I felt like I was in a democracy from everything I saw with my eyes as a journalist, right? Not perfect, obviously, but a democracy. How do you compare Iran, in your words? You've been there all your life, and you spent time in America, with the present American system that we have today in the United States. How would you compare the two countries? What do people need to know, Professor?
Well, first of all, no Iranian leader is in the Epstein files. And Iranian leaders in general, when people see them, their expectation is that they behave like ordinary people, that their expectation is that Iranian leaders are not very, that they shouldn't be very wealthy. Hmm. Not that private business or the private sector is something that is frowned upon, but the leaders, and especially the higher you go, they should not have a lifestyle that is that goes beyond the middle class, let's say.
Billionaires. And if, yeah.
Exactly. They shouldn't be billionaires. They shouldn't even be millionaires. That is the expectation of ordinary people, of Iranian leaders. And in addition, I'd say that, I mean, there are many problems in Iran. If you sit in a taxi, if you go in the subway, if you get on a bus in the city, you will see people say all sorts of things. They'll attack the government. They'll attack the leader. Some people will attack God, whatever. They'll say what they want to say. But in general, when you look at what is happening in Iran today, a war being waged on it, a siege against the country, literally by the collective West. If this Islamic Republic of Iran did not have popular support among this very highly educated nation, it's probably one of the most highly educated countries in the world.
Yes.
If they did not have the popular support, it would not last. Hmm. All these maximum pressure sanctions, all these wars, all these violent military insurrections that Western intelligence agencies carry out, it wouldn't last. And this war in particular, where you had the United States really bring in everything it had when it came to air power and missile power, and of course, with the help of their regional proxies and allies. The only reason why Iran was able to resist was, of course, it had a fantastic military strategy, underground bases, underground missile bases, and drone, all that. But that's true. But if you didn't have popular support, it would not have survived. It would not have survived. And again, I would advise your viewers to read that book, because there are very few good books in English on Iran. The book Going to Tehran by Flint and Hillary Leverett. And I think they'll see that the narrative on Iran is very different from reality.
Yeah.
And in fact, these two former government officials actually provide a way forward, and they were warning about what was happening, what would happen in future, and what exactly we're witnessing today. They were warning that this would happen.
Hey, Professor, thank you for joining us, really. I mean, I have a feeling the folks in the control room are saying, you know, we can't put Rick Sanchez and Professor Mirandi together again because they just talk for too long. Maybe it has to do with the fact that I'm Cuban and you're Persian and we just tend to talk a lot, but I don't know what it is. But I think
That's quite possible. There's actually... There are very, very strong similarities, in my opinion, from my experiences from Latin America, between Iranian culture and Latin American culture.
You kind of say that, and you're a good man. Thank you so much. Thank you so much, Professor, for taking time to join us once again. And we'll be talking again very soon, and hopefully I'll be visiting Tehran once again very soon.
Thank you for having me. It's always a
Yeah, it really is. Okay, so because we've gone a little long, we're not going to be able to share what we usually do at this time, which is we share the messages that you guys have given us. Instead, I just want to let you know how much I appreciate you being here, how much we appreciate you staying with us. And by the way, and this really is important, we want to thank you for joining us not just here, but on all of our social media channels in places like X, where lately we've been getting an inordinate amount of attention from you, as well as Spotify and BitChute. We'll be looking for you then. And thanks once again for making us a part of your plan daily and for letting us into your homes. I'm Rick Sanchez. We'll be looking for you next time.